It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
Socialization of transportation, education, energy, housing, and water. What it means is that government controls it through rules and regulations.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
Under this guise of bipartisanship and nonpartisanship, it's actually tapped down the truth.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
On an equal field in the battle of ideas, mistruths or misconceptions, and it is getting us into a world of hurt.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, let's have a conversation. Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson, and happy Monday to you. We've got an important show planned for you today. Today is Martin Luther King Day. And so later this morning, I will be going down to walk with Casper Stockham and his group in the parade today, the MLK Day Parade. And, you know, I really believe in this whole idea, this whole American idea that all of us are created equal and that we each have these inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And those are the precepts that this country was founded on. We don't always get it right, but we have the best ideal out there. I don't know of any other country that has come up with that social contract between its citizens and the vision of the country. And that's what makes America unique, and truly every one of us, no matter whatever our descriptor is, we have the inalienable right of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So it's going to be an important day today. And so I'll be going down there and walking with Casper Stockham a little bit later this morning. And then later in this show, we'll be talking with constitutional expert Rob Nadelson. A couple of questions. The first one, we had a listener last time Rob was on, asked Rob what the U.S. Constitution says about federal ownership of public lands. So that should be pretty fascinating. And then there is a case that on Wednesday the Supreme Court is going to hear. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear. It's Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. And that case actually may have significant implications for that single mom in the inner city whose kids are stuck in underperforming schools. And this case may actually have something to do with that, so you won't want to miss that. As we look at these issues, freedom versus force, force versus freedom, and we as Americans, I think we still prefer freedom. Socialism ultimately comes down to force. You can vote yourself into socialism, but it is tough to get yourself back out of it. We see this with all the rules and regulations and different laws that are being passed that are antithetical to the American idea. Once those laws are in place, it's pretty difficult to get back out of those. And remember, it's never compassionate to take other people's rights, their property, or freedom via force, whether it's with a weapon policy or unpredictable and excessive taxation. If something is a good idea, then it does not need force to implement it. So, Steve, I had something interesting. I typically am pretty inactive on my personal Facebook, but we had Rick Turnquest in studio on Friday with his important piece regarding family leave. And I'd posted it on my personal Facebook, and a young woman who I know her parents, let me just put it that way, but she's very worldly. Her mom is European. She grew up in Europe. And this was on this forced family leave question that we talked about on Friday. And she said that, yes, paid family leave is a right. And I'm paraphrasing, and the UN says that it's a right, and the United States needs to ratify that treaty. And so then I responded, can we agree that it's not okay that somebody comes up and puts a gun in somebody's ribs and says, give me your money, and robs them? And I think we basically all agreed. And then I said, well, taking money from one person to another via excessive taxation or rules and regulations, it's the same thing as sticking a gun in somebody's ribs and taking their money. And she responded back. She said, I think that's pretty, that's kind of sensationalizing the whole issue. And so I stepped back and thought about it for a minute, and I'm like, you know what? The outcome is the same, whether or not somebody comes up with a weapon and takes your money, or whether down at the Colorado State Legislature that they are passing rules and regulations and laws and fees and premiums that take your money. Steve, your comment?
Well, oh, geez. It's too early and it's Monday. The additive effect of that happening over and over again. Okay, here is the topic is family leave. But in this, I mean, get this woman to think about the additive effect of that program and this program and that program. And, you know, maybe later we'll be talking about, you know, we already know where we stand on all-day kindergarten, and that's in the red. And now I see that the governor is moving on to preschool. Mm-hmm. And so the additive effect of all this is pretty much the same, is that, you know, the gun might not be a physical gun. It's now taxation.
Well, and to that point regarding kindergarten and pre-kindergarten, again, I submit to you that a lot of the cost for childcare and the cost of raising a child increases significantly because of government regulation. So instead of now the government coming in and saying, we've made this so expensive and, oh, we're going to give this to you free, there's nothing for free. Like Elizabeth Warren, when she talks about free college, you know, we don't see that she actually, when she was a professor at Harvard, worked for free. So when they talk about free, they're talking about taking something from somebody else to give to somebody for free. And as you mention all the time, it's vote buying. In many ways, it's vote buying. But they're making something so expensive, it could be affordable, it could be housing. They're trying to make transportation so expensive, kindergarten, preschool, you know, all these things are so expensive. And then they come in with a government program when a lot of people, I think, would just prefer, get out of my way, lower the regulations, lower the rules, lower my taxes, let me have more money in my pocket, and let me make the decisions for myself. And there is always this comment, and I've heard it many, many times, that, oh, there's some people that just can't make those decisions for themselves. And I submit to you that I don't think that I buy that, Steve.
Well, as a side note there, let's not forget the price tag to Harvard to have Liz on their teaching staff was $425,000. Mm-hmm. So
that's not free college for sure.
No.
So, okay, jumping, let's go ahead and go through things. I always like to say thank you to the team. Steve, producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, and Charlie, for all that you do. And thank you to each of you listeners. It's a Monday morning. Go out there, strive for excellence. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. You have a purpose. There is a reason why you are here. So go out and do that. Be sure and check out my website, Kim Munson. That's MONSON.com. And our inspiration for today, it is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So obviously, I would go to him for some inspiration. Martin Luther King Jr. was an American Christian minister and activist who became the most visible spokesperson and leader in the civil rights movement from 1955 until his assassination in 1968. He was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and King is best known for advancing civil rights through nonviolence and civil disobedience inspired by his Christian beliefs. I've actually been to Atlanta and was at his boyhood home. And interestingly, I think that, I don't know if it was every Sunday, but on a regular basis, the family went around and had to recite a Bible verse that they had memorized. And Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite Bible verse was the shortest Bible verse there is in the Bible. Do you know what it is, Steve?
Jesus wept.
Yep, that's it. Jesus wept. You got it. So, okay.
I'm sure that brought down
the family.
Yeah, you know, in terms of his parents going,
Little kid. I love the creativity. So, okay. This is what he said. And instead of teaching our kids to be victims because of whatever descriptor there is, I thought this was pretty important. Martin Luther King Jr. said this. He said, if a man is called to be a street sweeper, he should sweep streets even as Michelangelo painted, or Beethoven composed music, or Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should sweep streets so well that all in the hosts of heaven and earth will pause to say, here lived a great street sweeper who did his job well. And if each of us go out and do our job well every day, all kinds of good things can happen, Steve.
Our friend Mike Opelka in the previous hour ran the actual audio of that mm-hmm. quote. And I've heard it before. And every time I hear it, I stop and think, it's like, be the best. You know, take the things you have been given and be the best. Go with it. Run with it.
And if you do, somebody will notice, and things typically work out pretty well. And so that is the opposite of victimhood, which we are teaching so many of our children these days. So are you ready for the funnies?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. A good friend called the other day. She said that last year she installed solar panels on her house to help lower her energy costs. But last week she got a call from the contractor complaining that his work had been completed a whole year and she had yet to pay him. She said, boy, oh boy, did we go around. Just because I'm blonde doesn't mean that I'm automatically stupid. So she proceeded to tell him what his fast-talking sales guy had told her last year. The sales guy had said that in 1 year, the solar panels would pay for themselves. There was silence on the other end of the line. So she hung up, and the contractor hasn't called back. Guess he was embarrassed.
I'm still waiting for my current set of windows to do that. So,
aren't we all?
And that, they were installed in 2002.
Okay, let's jump in here to some headlines. First headline, Republican Lois Landgraf, who is down at the State House, has offered a different take on family leave. We've been talking about this forced paid family leave and how bad it is and what it will do to, employees' relationships with each other. If one feels like they're taking advantage of the other, it'll create animosity. It starts out as a premium, I think, so that they don't have to go and ask us via TABOR, the Colorado's Taxpayers Bill of Rights. And then you've got an unelected bureaucrat that can increase those premiums at will. So it's a very, very bad deal. So Representative Lois Landgraf has said that there are two parts to the proposal. This is from Colorado Politics on family and medical leave that produced the most opposition from critics, that the program be mandatory and that it be run by the state. Proposals so far have had a mix. Democrat lawmakers favor a mandatory state-run program. Ugh. Others, like Pinnacle Assurance, are on board with mandatory but believe in private-run program would be preferable. Now, just bear in mind that Governor Polis said that if we have a private-run program, that Pinnacle Assurance will run that. So that's still kind of like government doing that because they're choosing who gets that contract. So a proposal authored by Representative Landgraf, Republican Colorado Springs, would do neither. Landgraf told potential stakeholders that making a family and medical leave program mandatory removes it as an incentive for businesses struggling to find workers in this tight labor market. Her proposal, which is still in discussion stages, would grant up to 12 weeks of paid family leave or medical leave per year. It works like this. An employee can contribute up to $6,750 per year to into a savings account and could do so as a pre-tax deduction. Employers who contribute to that employee's account would earn a tax credit of 25% of their contribution or receive a 25% tax credit if they pay at least 50% of that employee's wages while they're on leave. An account cannot exceed $24,000, and the account stays with the employee when they move to another job. However, the employer contribution does not stay in that account if the employee leaves. Another facet of Landgraf's proposal would allow hourly wage earners who make $23,660 per year or less to choose being paid time and a half for overtime or take it off, including as family leave. The proposal also allowed an employee who's nearing the end of anticipated family leave needs to make a one-time transfer of any remaining funds in the leave account to a qualified 529 account. Now, I like the fact that she's trying to address this. But, you know, there's a couple of things that are jumping out at me here, Steve. And that is there, okay, you could put your money in pre-tax. But how about we just lower taxes across the board so everybody has more money in their pocket so they can plan for their family's individual needs instead of having to come up with all these convoluted ideas. Now, I know she's pushing back on this paid forced family leave over here. But ultimately, how about let's lower taxes and get government out of that. Steve, your final comment before we go to break.
Well, once again, more bureaucracy in an already bloated system. Again, as you're explaining this and going through this article, I'm thinking, how did we make it to the year 2020 without this?
Good point. And if we continue to put, as you mentioned, on top of each other, all of these different laws, Ultimately, when Susan and Patty were in last week, we were looking at all these different things, forced minimum wage, forced paid family leave, force. And I said, how much of our money do they want? And Susan said they want all of it. Okay, on a lighter note, though, how about those Chiefs? Did you watch the games yesterday?
Yeah, I could say I basically watched all of the Chiefs game, not so much with the second game. I wasn't as interested as I was in the first one.
Well, it's going to be the Chiefs and the Niners. And the big game is right around the corner. And the place to watch the game is at Hooters Restaurants. They have plenty of TVs, so you can get all of the action. And if you join them for the big game, you will be entered in for a chance to win a 55-inch HD TV. And you can try their new roasted wings. I had folks over last night and did some of the smoked wings, and they were really, really good. And you can enjoy their new roasted wings as you watch the Avs and Nuggets chase their playoff spots. Wednesday is Dine-In Wing Day. All the wings you can eat for $15.99. That's a deal. That's a great deal. And if you don't want to cook like I didn't want to last night, I just had Hooters delivered right to my front door.
Well, not to put you on the spot, but aren't you having an event Wednesday night? And that be your food of choice?
It will be, yes. But the girls are coming over, and actually we might let you come over as well, because
Jason and I are already...
Are you? Okay. Yeah. No, yeah. Then I'll order some extra wings.
Because we want to meet your special guest, so I don't make sure that Hooters is on the menu.
It is, that's for sure. So let's go to break. When we come back, we'll continue with some more headlines. This is Kim Munson. We'll be right back.
A reverse mortgage can be an important financial tool for individuals 62 and older. It is essential to understand the process so that all of your questions are answered. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lauren Levy, Polygon Financial Group, has the experience to answer your questions. Lauren knows that each financial transaction is personal. If you'd like to explore your options on a reverse mortgage or with rates down, explore options to remodel your home, buy a rental property, or move, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website, kimmunson.com, and sign up for our weekly emails. And it's all kinds of great information about the upcoming shows. Steve, the next headline I want to go to is, this is from the Colorado Sun. It says, Denver officials on Thursday said that they would not hand over information requested by U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement, ICE, on four men waiting for or wanted for deportation. ICE, the Homeland Security Agency tasked with arresting and deporting people in the U.S. illegally, sent four administrative subpoenas earlier this week to law enforcement looking for information on three Mexican nationals and one Honduran who had been in custody in Denver. It was the first time subpoenas had been sent to a law enforcement agency. An escalation of the conflict between the Trump administration and the so-called sanctuary cities. Henry Lucero, Deputy Executive Associate Director for ICE's Enforcement and Removal Operations, said Wednesday that the agency doesn't want to get into the business of subpoenaing fellow law enforcement agencies. He called it a last resort. But because of changes in how municipalities work with ICE, it could be necessary to expand the practice to other cities in order to catch dangerous people and deport them. Steve, this whole thing regarding, you know, taking out Soleimani, you know, the terrorist over there in Iran, and then you've seen the left, the radical activists that have taken over the Democrat Party. So you see these people from the far left. And the veil is off. They seem to like the bad guys more than they like everyday, hardworking Americans. I think that once again, you can see that right here with what is happening regarding Denver, the city of Denver, protecting four bad guys from ICE. And so, again, the veil is off. I think people need to realize that you put these bad guys out on the streets again, and bad things could happen, right?
This story comes, timing is everything. I'm not going to say it's good timing, it's just timing. In the wake of a story last week out of the New York City area, 92-year-old woman raped and murdered by an illegal. Okay, here we are again. And look at the last, you know, take a look at that last paragraph there, at their, what they've been up to, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. One of the men sought by ICE was from Mexico and had been arrested for sexual assault, another for vehicular homicide, and a third for child abuse and a strangulation assault. The Honduran man arrested on domestic violence charges. All had been removed from the country previously. They're back.
Okay, I'm going to connect the dot and tell me if I'm stretching a bit.
Do it.
Okay, so we've got, I mean, this is the policies. This is the policies of the far left that has taken over the Democrat Party, which has taken over the state house and the governor's mansion here in Colorado. So here we've got Governor Polis, who is continuing the drumbeat on all-day kindergarten, you know, now a government-run pre-K. But then you've got a bad guy here who had abused a child, strangulation assault, and they want to let the guy go. The things don't match up, Steve. They don't match up. And we as parents can keep our kids safer than putting them in this government-run kindergarten and pre-K.
If we are a nation of laws, and I truly believe we are, how much can you let people trample on those laws? Number one, they're here, not legally. Number two, once they get here, they're behaving in such a way, how many different laws can they break?
Well, and one other thing to mention, though, when we say that we are a country of laws, those are laws that have to pass the muster of the vision of the Declaration that all men are created equal. So in that case, all of us have to be equal under the law. No special laws. Law, justice should not be partial. And when you start to have special rights for one group, you know, depending on whatever their descriptor is, then you no longer have, you know, equal representation under the laws. And so it is important when we say we are a nation of laws, the laws have to pass the muster of the vision of the Declaration and the Constitution. Otherwise, they are illegal laws. Could be like the red flag laws. They do not pass the muster of the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. So even though that is a law, I submit to you it's an illegal law.
Well, what better thing to say on Martin Luther King Day? He was big on the unjust laws, and you know that was something that he propagated in his civil disobedience. He said there are laws out there that are not, you know, that don't line up with our Judeo-Christian heritage, right, and the way our government was formed.
Right. And so let's say just one other thing, and because we'll get to Jason McBride here in just a little bit. Once again, here in Colorado, this is from 9 News. Legislation to repeal Colorado's death penalty has been filed in the state Senate. 3 of the bill sponsors are Republicans. In its current iteration, Senate Bill 2100, so when you look at those, it would be like SB 20, so the year 20, and then it has a bill number. So this is SB 2100, repeals the death penalty for offenses charged on or after July 1, 2020. This means if the legislation is passed, the 3 offenders on Colorado's death row will remain there unless Governor Jared Polis commutes their sentences. The senators are Jack Tate, Republican, Arapahoe County, Owen Hill, Republican, El Paso County, and Kevin Priola, Republican, Adams County. They're co-sponsors of the bill. Since Democrats control both the state house and the Senate, the repeal is likely to pass. The 3 men currently on Colorado's death row are Nathan Dunlap. You probably remember he was convicted of killing 4 employees at a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant in Aurora in 1993. And he was granted a temporary reprieve by Governor John Hickenlooper. Robert Ray arranged the murder of 2 witnesses to another killing that he committed. One of those victims, Javad Marshall Fields, is the son of current state senator Rhonda Fields, Democrat from Arapahoe County. And then Sir Mario Owens was convicted in the 2005 killing Marshall Fields and his fiancée Vivian Wolfe. The ACLU recently released a report in opposition to Colorado's death penalty, calling it expensive and ineffective. The report also argued that the lengthy appeals process that follows the death penalty sentencing is expensive for taxpayers and traumatizing for families. 18th Judicial District Attorney George Brockler, who tried and failed to secure the death penalty for the man convicted of gunning down The 12 people inside the Aurora movie theater argued that it's a tool prosecutors can use to prevent families from enduring emotionally taxing trials. There are a significant number of huge cases that do not go to trial because the defendants plead guilty and get life without parole to avoid death, Brockler said. So once again, Steve, we've got the Democrats, and I mean, all the Democrats will probably vote for this, vote for the bad guys. I am a little frustrated when we have Republicans that join in on that. And I know these Republicans, and I like them very much. But I do think that it's important that when they are sponsoring bad bills, that we need to mention that, Steve.
I read this one with very mixed emotion. I mean, I just mentioning the three Republicans, I thought was inserted just to maybe soften this and say, well, see, everybody's for this. I don't know about that. And again, if you want to be factual in your reporting, why don't you give us the dollar amount spent on those three gentlemen? I use the term loosely. What's been spent on them so far since they've been on death row?
Now, one other thing I do want to mention is the Dems, who seem to want to protect these three killers that are on death row, or that want to protect these guys that are here illegally that have committed pretty significant crimes, but over here protecting those on death row. Yet the Dems, the radical activist Dems, are always wanting to protect abortion. And abortion, we're learning that when the baby is aborted, the baby feels pain. They're not giving the complete information to the mother regarding the ultrasound. So again, this is things that don't match up. You want to protect the killers that are on death row, but you won't stand to protect the most vulnerable in the womb. And somehow those two things don't match up to me. It seems like we'd want to protect children and not the bad guys, Steve.
Absolutely. The word is dichotomy.
Okay. Let's talk to Jason McBride. Jason, do you have any comments on on what we're talking about today?
Well, I'll tell you, Kim, every time I hear that they're protecting illegals that have come to the country and committed horrific crimes and they release them back onto the street, really just to kind of thumb their nose at President Trump and thumb their nose at ICE and our Border Patrol, yeah, it really upsets me and it makes me angry. And I hope some of these subpoenas and being able to reduce federal funds are effective. I mean, I hate to see it happen in Colorado because it affects our state, but at the end of the day, you've got to stand up for what's right, even if, you know, it kind of hurts your own backyard a little bit, I think.
Well, and, you know, that is one of the first and foremost things here is people want to make sure that their families are safe. And safe from the bad guys. And so what's happening down at the State House is making it more dangerous. But, Jason, there was another thing I wanted to ask you, and that was that the market was up about 30% last year, and it's off to a pretty good start this year. Is it getting too high too fast?
Well, Kim, it may be a little bit extended over the really short term here, but that certainly doesn't mean it can't go higher. If you look, it's had good reason to move up recently with two major trade deal signed that help really level the playing field in the favor of the United States of America. So our market should be happy.
Well, that's very true. But now you say the 30% gain from last year also sounds a lot bigger than it really was. And why is that?
Well, that's not a knock on the market or economy. It's just easy to forget that the last quarter of 2018, Kim, was a really tough one. If you remember, the market dropped 20% between October 3rd and Christmas Eve. It bounced a little bit by year end, but we started off 2019 with the market close to the bottom of a trough. So when you get that big sell-off right at the end of the year, it could kind of skew the numbers for the next year.
Got it. So you say that 2019 was good, but part of that was just a bounce from that low point.
Well, it really was. The S&P, if you look, hit about 29.40 in October of 18. On December 31st, it was at 25.06. So that's, over 400 points down off the top. So really, Kim, it had to move up 17% just to get back to the old high of 29.40, which it did by April. And between there and the year-end 2019 number, it was about a 10% gain.
Okay, so that's a good year, but it's probably not as overheated as it sounds.
Well, I think so, Kim. That's right. And really, the market, if you look a little bit longer term, it had been going pretty much sideways for almost 2 years since early 2018. And it was only in November of last year that it really started breaking out to solid new highs. So it's had a rest for a couple of years to kind of gain its strength again for another run, so to speak.
Well, and you sent me a chart, and it's interesting how it looks similar for 2 years before the Trump election, just sideways and then a straight-up move.
Well, that's right, Kim. If you look from Election Day until the upward move stalled, we gained about 31%. But before that, we went sideways since early 2014. So again, it was about a two-year sideways movement before the big boom. The chart looks similar now, and I'm not saying we're going to go straight up 31% from here without taking a breath, and there will always be pullbacks, and you don't know when those are going to come, but looking at all of these facts, you know, we may not be as overheated right now as it might sound like when people keep talking about being up 30% last year.
Okay, great information. Love the chart. And, Jason, one other thing. We talked about the Secure Act last week, and that was that whole, all those changes in Social Security. And you've got a report for that. I would highly recommend that people reach out to you and get that. So reach out to Jason at AIRpresidential.com. That's AIRpresidential.com. Jason, you have a great day. I know the markets are closed today, so thanks for being on the air bright and early on a Monday morning.
You're a slave driver. You know, you wouldn't even give me a day off.
I know it.
I wasn't even asking for paid leave, just unpaid leave, and you said no.
I know.
So I need your listeners to know who you really are.
There is no rest for the weary. So, Jason
That's
McBride,
right.
Thank you so much.
Have a great show, Kim.
Okay, we're going to go to break. When we come back, Rob Nadelson is on the line, and you know him. He is an expert on the U.S. Constitution, has a great book, What the U.S. Constitution Says and Means. I don't think I have that title quite exactly right, but it's a great book. And we have two questions on the table. One, we had a listener ask after he was on last time, what does the U.S. Constitution say about federal ownership of public lands? And then this case that the U.S. Supreme Court's going to listen to on Wednesday regarding Espinoza and the Montana Department of Revenue. It is an important case. This is Kim Munson. We'll be right back.
Award-winning realtor Karen Levine has 30 years of experience with RE/MAX Alliance. As a director with the National Association of Realtors, Karen Levine works to protect private property rights. Karen Levine believes in home ownership. Because of Karen's love of dogs, Karen volunteers with GRR, Golden Retriever Rescue of the Rockies, helping golden retrievers find their forever homes. Choose Karen Levine to buy or sell your home because she understands that it's more than just a house. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance today at 303-877-7516. That's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson, and I'm thrilled to have on the line with me Rob Nadelson. He is an expert on the U.S. Constitution. And okay, Rob, I'm going to try to get the title of your book correct from memory. It's The U.S. Constitution, What It Said and Meant, or What It Really Said and Meant. Am I close?
The original Constitution, what it actually said and meant. And by the way, if you're the slave driver, then you're also the slave, because here you are on a federal holiday, up early in the morning, in the studio, working, and all the rest of us just have to lie around at home and call in when necessary. So I don't think that complaints about you are justified, even though I admit you are a slave driver.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, you know, there's so much we need to talk about. And Rob Nadelson, you know, always learn so much. So first question, last time you were on, I got a message from a listener. They said, What does Rob Nadelson say, or what does he think the U.S. Constitution says about federal ownership of public lands? So let's bite that off. What's your comments?
Well, let's do the short answer first. If you go to the Independence Institute website and you click on the Constitution tab, you'll see a page that says books and articles by Rob Nadelson. If you go to that tab, books and articles about by Rob Nadelson, and you scroll down or you use the search feature and look for the word land, you'll see that I actually wrote an article many years ago, which appeared in the University of Colorado Law Review.
Cool.
And by the way, that was only by chance because I wasn't living in Colorado at the time. I was teaching at the University of Montana. But it was on the issue that your listener raises. Is there, under the original and proper interpretation of the Constitution, a power of the federal government to own land? And if you want to, I can get into some of the weeds with you.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, well, when I got into this issue, I found there were two contending schools of thought. There was a contending school of thought on the left, which essentially said the federal government can own land for any duration, any amount, any purpose it wants to. And that is also the position of the current Supreme Court and has been since the New Deal years, the years when the court kind of threw in the towel and stopped limiting Congress. Then there were people on the right who argued that the only way the federal government could own federal land is if it goes through a procedure outlined in what's called the Constitution's Enclave Clause. The Enclave Clause says that the federal government may acquire land with the permission of the state in which the land is located. It may purchase the land or take a jurisdiction over the land and then administer it directly. A great example is the District of Columbia. That's a federal enclave. And a more local example is the Denver Federal Center in Lakewood. That is a federal enclave. And that was intended for either the national capital or for fairly small areas like buildings and bases like military bases and also installations like the Denver Federal Center. And so those folks argued on the right that the only way the federal government could own land properly was if it went through the enclave procedure. I investigated the question. I looked very carefully at the text of the Constitution, as I always do. I looked at how the discussions at the time of that the Constitution was ratified and understandings of the terms in those years. And what I discovered is the truth actually lies, as it often does, somewhere in between. What I found was that the when the federal government was founded, it had ownership over certain territories, like the Northwest Territories. It was expected to dispose of them, but that otherwise the federal government could own whatever land it chose to own so long as it owned that land for an enumerated purpose. That is to say, so long as it owned the land for some purpose outlined in the Constitution. So, for example, the federal government has the power to raise taxes. It therefore has the power to acquire a building, a tract of land, in which to house the tax collectors. It has the power to regulate commerce. Going along with that, it was understood the ability to build lighthouses and ports and piers and of course, housing for the regulators. What it could not do, however, under the original Constitution, was to simply own land for the sake of owning land, as it currently does with the Bureau of Land Management, most of their land, and it could not own land for unenumerated purposes. So that raises the question as to whether the national parks are really constitutional. And let me just finish up this lengthy answer, Kim, by saying I'm not proposing that the national parks be handed over to developers for condos or that they be auctioned off. The Constitution also contemplates various ways in which federal land can be disposed of, including putting environmental treasures into perpetual nonprofit trusts to protect them from development and also to protect them from from bureaucratic incompetence. And that's a system that's widely done with some of the treasures, national treasures in Great Britain.
Okay, so, you know, so a lot of the West is owned by the federal government.
Yes.
So what would your comment be about that? I mean, it seems to me that people, you know, that live in those states, that they would better take care of it than the federal government. However, I do love the fact that the Bureau of Land Management is moving its headquarters, you know, out to the West to Grand Junction, so it's closer to the people. But do you think that actually we should start to move this federal land to states, or what do you think?
Well, you know, the movement of the BLM to the West, it's okay, but it's really, it's not even a half measure. It's not even a 5% measure. We in the Denver metro area tend to be insulated because in some ways, you know, Denver's like Boston plunked down in the middle of the West. If you get outside the Denver metro area into the rest of Colorado and to the remainder of the Rocky Mountain West, you'll see that people are very, very upset with federal land management policies, and they have been for a long time. And they agree that, yes, people closer to home could manage the land better. Now, what do you do? About 28% of the country is now owned by the federal government, which creates all kinds of huge political and constitutional problems, really major problems, which I could go into, but it would take too long.
Okay.
And about half the West, including 87% of the state of Nevada, is owned by the federal government. Again, very serious distortion. So what do you do with all the land? It depends upon the land. In the case of the national parks, I think they need to be protected. I'm an outdoorsman, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and but I think that we can do better than having the feds own them. What we could do is we could transfer them into perpetual nonprofit trusts, insulated both from development pressures and also from bureaucratic pressures. In the case of, on the other extreme, a lot of the land owned by the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is just grazing land or land that has no purpose really there's really no reason for the government to own it. You can make a strong argument that that should just be sold to the highest bidder. There's other land like much of the forests. Some of the national forests are very beautiful. They don't have special purposes other than for watershed and so forth. And you can, there are solutions for those that are somewhere in between. One example is to take some of the national forest land and convey it to state governments, either with or without promises from the state government to maintain it as parks. If you go up to northern Colorado and you look at Colorado State Forest and you compare it to the surrounding federal forest, you will find that Colorado State Forest is a lot less prone to disease, bugs, fire, and so forth than Colorado State Forest.
The National Forest. The Colorado is better than the National, right?
It's better than the National Forest, that's
mm-hmm.
right. And this isn't just impressionistic. If you go up there, you can see it. You know, I got some photographs to show you what the National Forest looks like compared with the State Forest. But it's not just impressionistic. There actually have been several studies indicating that the states as a whole take better care of land than the federal government does. So the people on the right, when I mentioned there was a school of thought on the right, they tend to take the position, oh, just hand over the land, all the land to the states. I did not find that position consistent with the Constitution because the land has to be disposed of under such circumstances as is for the best interest of the American people. And some of the land should be given to the states, but that's not the case with all of it.
Okay, fascinating. Rob, thank you so much. And again, where can people find that article? It's at the Independence Institute, and you go to you, is that right?
You go to the Constitution page at the Independence Institute, and then you'll see a tab for articles and books by Rob Nadelson. And there are a lot of articles there, but if you just search for the word land, you'll find it. It's called The Original Understanding of Federal Land Retention, something like that, in the University of Colorado Law Review.
Fascinating. So, Rob Nadelson, we're going to go to break. When we come back, there is a really important case that you have been watching, and that is Espinoza versus the Montana Department of Revenue. And this could actually have far-reaching effects, at least to my understanding, for that you know, that single mom in inner city, wherever, who's so frustrated with her kids being in underperforming schools. I mean, this could have some real importance for her, right?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll talk with Rob Nadelson. This is Kim Munson. Stay tuned.
You want to succeed, so you need to dress for the job, event, or relationship that you seek. For more than 30 years, entrepreneur and stylist Kim Munson has been helping women look their very best. And guys, Kim can help you with made-to-measure shirts that fit great and you'll love to wear. Guys and gals, if you want to up your game, freshen your look, email Kim at KimMunson.com for your initial style consult. Kim at Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, KimMunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out my website, Kim Munson. That's M-O-N-S-O-N.com. It is a beautiful website, so be sure and go and take a look at that. On the line with me is Rob Nadelson. He is a constitutional expert. He's been cited in courts all the way up to the Supreme Court, and there is something very important that is happening this Wednesday. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear the case Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. Rob Nadelson, tell our listeners why this is important.
It's important because it can affect your ability to control where you're going to send your child to school over the long haul. The case arose in the state of Montana because Montana has a provision in its state constitution that forbids any program of school choice or other kind of state assistance that includes sectarian institutions. And in some ways, this case centers around that phrase, that word sectarian. About 5 years ago, there was a case in the Colorado Supreme Court dealing with a provision in the Colorado Constitution, which is very similar to that in Montana. And you recall at that time, the Douglas County School Board had a program. It was called a voucher program, but it really was not. It was a kind of school choice program that allowed parents under certain circumstances to send their kids to religious schools. And that was struck down by the Colorado Supreme Court on the grounds that religious schools were, quote, sectarian. Well, similarly, the Montana Supreme Court struck down a school choice program more recently, just last year, on the grounds that it gave aid to sectarian schools. I have to say that the Montana Supreme Court's justification was a little bit was less strong than the Colorado Supreme Court, but both courts really had it wrong. These provisions banning aid to so-called sectarian schools exist in about 30 state constitutions. They're sometimes called Blaine Amendments, but that really is a misnomer, but that's the phrase that's sometimes used to describe them. In order to understand the doctrine of the case, you have to understand a little bit about First Amendment religion law. Essentially, there are two rules that are relevant that the courts have developed for the state and religion. One is that states may not discriminate against religion, and one is that states may not discriminate among religions. There are other rules too, but those are the two at issue in this case. The states may not discriminate against religion, and they may not discriminate among religions. Now, in the case of discriminating against religion, sometimes the states can get away with it. For example, the state of Washington decided at one point they were going to give aid to college students, but not to any college student who was studying for a devotional degree, studying to become a minister. The Supreme Court said that's okay. If you want to stay away from religion, you don't have to fund minister courses, so long as you also don't fund rabbinical courses or courses for the Islamic clergy, so long as you treat all the religions equally. So you can lean against religion somewhat, according to the Supreme Court. The other rule is that you can't discriminate among religions, and that's a much stronger rule. And the court is much more skeptical if it sees a state or federal regulation that seems to pick and choose favorites among religion. Okay, now we come to the nub of the case. The argument made by the states, and most of the discussion of the case has been, they've been assuming that this word sectarian, that you can't aid sectarian institutions, simply means religious. That's how the Colorado Supreme Court defined it. We don't want to fund any education programs that includes religious education because we don't want the state to become entangled with religion. Of course, the folks on the other side, the advocates for the schools, say, well, you've really gone too far in discriminating against religion. What we at the Independence Institute did is we decided we need to change the narrative in this case. We need to change the focus in this case because the word sectarian in the state constitutions does not mean religious. It refers to certain types of religion. It's actually a word inserted in these state constitutions to allow the states to pick and choose among religions. And when they were adopted, the purpose of it was mostly so the states could discriminate against Catholic schools, so the states could discriminate against Jewish schools, Muslim schools, and in favor of mainline Protestant schools. In fact, even evangelicals, Protestant evangelicals who were viewed as too enthusiastic, were labeled as sectarian. And so the purpose of these provisions in these state constitutions, Colorado and Montana, is not just to kind of get the state to lean against religion and avoid entanglement against religion, but to actually discriminate among religions. So we submitted a friend of the court brief to the U.S. Supreme Court explaining this and saying, look, you know, as bad as it is to discriminate against religion, these clauses are actually worse, and you need to take a position that these clauses will not be tolerated.
Okay, so Rob Nadelson, why does this matter to somebody that has their kid in an underperforming school, wants to get him out of one school into another school? Why does this matter to this parent?
Well, let's use the Montana case, for example. The Montana public schools, for the most part, are not bad, but they don't suit everybody, you know? I mean, sometimes your kid is the proverbial square peg in a round hole. That could be any number of reasons. It could be developmental disabilities. It could be personality differences. It could be that the local school isn't very good, that even if the school is as a rule are okay, your local school isn't very good. That happened to me, in fact, when I was in high school. I went out of district. It may be that you believe that your kid should be imbued with religious values. And that you don't like the E. coli culture that exists in many of the public schools today. Whatever the reason, you're in the best position to decide for your own family and for your own kids what school to send your child to. Anyway, the Montana legislature had passed a program, very modest one, which said that if somebody grants money, if somebody gives a contribution to a scholarship organization, he can take a tax credit off a state income tax, limited to $150, a very, very small program. These scholarship organizations would decide whether they wanted to aid kids attending religious schools or not. The kids themselves would decide whether or not they wanted to attend, and their families, whether to attend religious schools or not. The state wouldn't be involved in any of this. And yet the Montana Supreme Court said, well, the fact that a parent might choose a religious school and that a scholarship organization might choose to fund that family, and the fact that someone might give to that scholarship organization, which might choose to fund that family, which might choose a religious school, violates the anti-sectarian clause of the Montana Constitution. Well, it's ridiculous on the face of it, but it exemplifies how these vicious anti-sectarian clauses adopted for the purpose of discriminating against religious minorities are used by the public school establishment and their apologists to deny educational opportunities to children and their families.
Well, educational opportunities, every child is unique. And so a one-size-fits-all educational approach does not work. And letting families have the choice on how to best educate their individual child is so important. So this is so amazing. I worked really hard on that Douglas County School Board race because I saw how important it was regarding that particular Supreme Court case. And, of course, the radical activist left won that election, and they immediately stopped that Supreme Court case. And ultimately, it hurts that mom or dad in inner city, in the inner city trying to get their kid out of a bad school.
Kim, I feel this personally, okay? When I was in ninth grade, it was clear that the high school I was going to, the local public high school, was not serving me well. We had one teacher, for example, who was literally a mental case, who was removed in the end of the at the beginning of the year and mm-hmm. institutionalized. We had another teacher who was not serving us well. We had some good teachers as well, but generally speaking, the environment in that school was toxic, and I was absolutely miserable. And I campaigned with my parents. I was precocious. I campaigned mm-hmm. with my parents and said, "Please send me somewhere else."
And Rob,
my father was.
We're about out of time, so a great story. Finish up quickly.
Well, my father was able to afford to send me somewhere else, and I flourished. But most families can't afford that, and school choice is about giving all families that opportunity.
Love it. And take a look at this piece. It's at Complete Colorado. It's Rob Nadelson's piece, forthcoming case, a chance for high court to strike down bigoted state constitution rules. Rob Nadelson, thank you so much. You have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, our quote for today is Martin Luther King Jr. He says, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." So today, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.